Episode 11 seeks to answer the question, how does interference relate to quantum computing? Topics covered include an overview of interference, the limitations related to reading the states of qubits, amplitude amplification, and an introduction to the concept of an oracle. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Good morning, Cyprian. How are you doing?
Good morning, Patrick. Very well, thank you. How are you? Ready for a new Entangled Things episode?
I am. This is another one of our topic episodes, and we're going to talk about a very vital part of quantum computing, quantum calculation, really. And that's the interference and how that is used to make the things go, if you will, make the trains move. So what would you want to impart to someone if they ask the question, what's this interference thing got to do with quantum computing?
Well, I think it all starts from a very simple question, which has a very complicated response, and that is, how do we approach the design of algorithms in quantum computing? Because the most important limitation that we have is the one related to reading state. We have covered this in many of our previous episodes. And just a quick reminder to our listeners, right? Whenever you attempt to read the state of a qubit, or for that matter, a system of qubits, multiple qubits, that state will collapse and you get one of the so-called ground states, right? Either a zero or a one if we want to use a notation that is similar to classical computing, which means that whenever you need to implement an algorithm in quantum computing, the big problem that you have is one of the things that we take for granted in classical computing, which is reading the state of variables, is actually not available in quantum computing. So you need to find a way to actually do that, or a way to write or design an algorithm that does not require to read intermediate states in this process, right? Patrick, isn't that like kind of mind-bending in itself?
It is. It's a distortion of the way we would normally think about it, approaching it. It's kind of like, I want you to pick up an olive off the table without touching it. Or I want you to, it's even worse, it's probably don't think of the color green for the next 3 minutes. It's really hard to imagine how you can do something without just straight ahead doing it. But there are ways, there's mechanisms, and interference is a big part of that, isn't it?
Yep. The analogy that I like to provide to that, which is a little bit forced, so I would straight from the beginning say it's not an accurate analogy, but for somebody who does not have deep knowledge in quantum computing, I think it's useful. Think of a classical computing problem where what you need to do is, or what you are allowed to do, you are only allowed to write into a database, but you are never allowed to read it. Or to be more accurate, you are allowed to read it only once. So basically, your challenge, if we use classical computing analogies, is to have a database in an initial state. You are allowed to write into that database any number of times, and then you are only allowed to read once at the end. And based on the results of that read, you need to be able to derive the solution to your problem. Is that analogy making sense, Patrick, to you?
It does. It's a strange set of requirements, but it's imposed by physics, and so we have to accept them. It means that you have to be creative about how you approach the problem. It's not as simple as 1 + 1 = 2. There's a lot of inference going on, isn't there?
Yeah. And then this I think this sets up nicely the stage for our discussion today. The other thing that I would like to bring into discussion is numbers of qubits. We have, especially in the earlier episodes of our podcast, we have discussed a lot about the properties of individual qubits. We have described the qubit, the limitations, and things like that. But we've also said that while it's nice to work and understand and learn the math of how a qubit behaves, a qubit in itself is not really helpful in quantum computing. What we really, really need to have is systems of multiple qubits. And there are a minimum number of qubits that would provide you, for example, that state which is commonly referred in the industry today as quantum supremacy, which we have covered in one of our episodes as well. So in a nutshell, it all boils down to quantum computers providing a number of stable qubits, ideally in the hundreds or even in the thousands or tens of thousands, which we are quite far from as of today. And those are the types of quantum systems that would really allow us to perform these computations. And even if this seems like a daunting task, like how do you write algorithms given these limitations, there are already proven algorithms out there. One of them we have covered in quite some detail, Patrick, is the factorization algorithm, right? Which is one of the first algorithms or among the first algorithms that were initially mathematically designed. And I think they have been already proven for some small numbers, right?
Yes. Yeah. Like 21 most recently, 15 before that for prime, factoring of primes, Shor's algorithm.
Yeah. Yeah. So turns out that there are multiple techniques for achieving the task of implementing an algorithm. And the one that we will discuss about today is a specific one, which is called amplitude amplification. And obviously, we're not going to get into the math behind this because the math behind the algorithm is quite complex. Instead of that, I would like to provide an example of an application, an early application of this approach, which is Grover's algorithm, also known as the quantum search algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an interesting algorithm, Patrick, because it is not like the shining star category, meaning it does not provide you exponential speed up over its classical counterparts, right? It's kind of like a well-established thing that the promise of quantum is you will get exponential improvement speed ups over a range of problems that today are very difficult to solve. Instead of that, Grover's algorithm, which is an example, an early application of amplitude amplification, provides you a quadratic speedup, which, if you look at it from the lens of expectations from quantum computing, is not that big, right? But if you look at it for practical reasons, a quadratic speedup is huge, right?
If you look at it actually in terms of where quantum computing is, quantum computing is in its infancy. The fact that it has any speed up at all offers promises for the future, I think. So I think you're right. I think some people might look at it as, oh, well, it's only a polynomial or quadratic speed up, but any speed up for an a technology in its infancy offering any speed up at all promises better things in the future.
Yes. And, If we were to describe the problem of quantum search, like think about you have a list of items, generically speaking, and you have to to find one that matches a certain criteria, right? Like, I don't know, you have a bunch of, you have a bag with items of all of them are white, and there is one that is, let's say, red, correct? And then you cannot see when you put your hand into the bag, you are extracting one item at a time. You cannot see which one do you extract, but once you extract it, you can look at it. You can see whether it's white or red, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then the problem is finding the red one. And in classical computing, right, no matter what you do, the complexity will be basically depending on the number of items that you have in a bag. This is what we call, right, a complexity of n, which is directly proportional to the number of items, because statistically, right, you will need to kind of check about half of the items before you are able to get your result. Obviously, in very, like, in border cases, you will extract the red one the first time, or you will extract the red one the last time you draw an item clearly,
right?
But on average, it will take like 50%, and that's a complexity of N. Now, what's interesting about the Grover algorithm, the quantum search algorithm, is that it promises to do it in an order of the square root of N. So that means for example, if you are guessing a 128-bit symmetric cryptographic key, like with classical approaches, so to speak, right? You will be somewhere along that 2 at the power of the complexity is linked to 2 at the power of 128, which is huge. With Grover, you can actually do it in 2 at the power of 64 iteration, which interestingly enough, even since the Grover algorithm was published, there is already there are suggestions that all symmetric key lengths should be doubled as we speak to protect against potential quantum attacks using this type of algorithm, which is already a huge thing in itself, right?
Yeah, it is. It basically means that even with the search algorithms are dangerous. Even the not just the ones that are meant to go after cryptography have implications on security.
Yep. And then finally, the third thing that we need to kind of put on the table for today's discussion is the concept of an oracle. And that's a very interesting one in quantum computing. Basically, an oracle is a function that allows you to recognize the solution of your problem. And here's where we need to draw a very, very, very important line and distinction between recognizing the solution of a problem and finding the solution of a problem, right? Because there's a lot of confusion over that. Now, getting back to the analogy of the bag with items that are all white and one of them is red, like finding the solution of the problem is the process of drawing one item at a time out of the bag, looking at it, evaluating its color, and then putting it aside and then drawing another one all the way until you find the result, right? That's the process of finding the solution. Now, recognizing the solution is actually the small part where you look at the item, you decide whether it's white or red, and if it's red, your result will be true, and if it's white, your result will be false. That's recognizing the solution. And am I making sense here, Patrick, with this important distinction?
You are. It's a subtle difference. It's a very subtle difference, and it's a way of thinking that's different than most people are used to.
Yep. Yep. And this is a great example, by the way, as a side note, this is a great example of some of the subtleties that we need to get into with quantum computing in order to be able to kind of overcome those limitations. So let's think about the Oracle as just something that is capable of recognizing the solution to our problem. So I think now we have this concept, so to speak, the concepts that we need to start explaining at a very simplified and a very high level, the way Grover's algorithm works and the way that amplitude amplification works. So everything in quantum computing starts from what we call an initial state. If you have one qubit, then you reset that qubit in one of the, basic states, let's say 0 or 1, right? If you have multiple qubits, say you have 1,000 qubits, then resetting the system means that you reset all the bits into their basic state. Let's say we put all of them into the state of 0 or something yep. like that. And that is something, Patrick, that is easily achievable today. Like, this is known stuff. We already have ways to even physically do that with the qubits that we have today. So
right. It's the first step of every process.
Exactly, exactly. Everything in any kind of quantum algorithm starts with that. And the challenge is, once you have this initial state, the challenge is to apply transformations to this state repeatedly. So the other thing that we can do today is we can change the states of qubits. We in universal quantum computing, in universal quantum computing, those are called gates. And when you apply these gates to qubits, you can change their state in a predictable way. So
right.
that is something else that we can do already today, right?
Yep.
Now, the challenge of this class of algorithms is, you take your 1,000 qubits, for example, you put them in an initial state, then you apply some smart changes to the states of those qubits repeatedly, and then at some point, when you think you're done, you just measure the state of the system. And measuring the state of the system is nothing else than measuring every single qubit. So think of it like, if you start from all zeros, you apply a number of transformations, and then at some point you go reading like 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, and so forth, which are the individual states of qubit. Does that make sense in terms of a very general approach?
It does, but let me add a little bit of my understanding to this. My understanding is that as we're doing these iterations, each iteration should force the correct solution's probability in the model to 1 and the probability of incorrect answers to 0.
Exactly. So I think you've actually nailed it, Patrick. The fabulous property of these iterations, which, by the way, are called, surprise, surprise, Grover iterations, right, is that it moves the state of your quantum system a little bit closer to the final solution, to the actual solution, so to speak.
And right? Isn't it? The number of iterations is calculable as like n minus 1, or I forget.
Actually,
the number of
iterations is proportional to the square root of the space of your problem. So let's put it into some numbers that will be easy to follow. Let's say you have 8 items in your bag, right? Mm-hmm. So in order to model that, you will need 3 qubits because We know that the number of states that you can model, right, is 2 at the power of the number of qubits that you have, because this is the way that the state management happens in quantum computing.
It's the number of combinations for 3 bits is 8.
Exactly. So yeah. Basically, you have 3 qubits, and let's say that your solution is the combination 101, right? Out of all the 8 possible combinations of the red states of your qubits, because the reason why we operate here with zeros and ones is because we actually operate with results after reading. And remember, after reading a qubit, you can only get 0 or 1, right? Nothing else. So let's assume the result is identified by a state of your 3 qubits as being 1, 0, and 1. So the way amplitude amplification actually works is you start from an initial state that you initialize. It's a well-known state, right? So there's no magic there. And then as you apply these iterations, your system moves closer and closer and closer to a state where if you read it, it will be 101. And that's basically the magic of the search algorithm when applied using qubits. And there is a lot of math involved in how to define that iteration, what are the properties, how to do the initial state of the system, and so forth. And obviously, we're not going to dive into those. But what's remarkable here is that you can prove the fact that this works. Now, because we are in the world of quantum, there is another thing we must say, right? There's a probability that you will find the solution, but not a guarantee, right? So the amplitude amplification approach, what it actually says is that applying these iterations would put you in a position where there will be a high probability that what you read at the end is your actual solution, but it's not guaranteed, which means that it is possible that you do not find the solution at the end of the process. And then obviously what you will do is you will just scrap everything, reset your system, and then just try it again.
Well, or you could also at that point do a post-processing with a classical computer. So for example, let's say it said there's an 80% chance that this is the answer, and it's a 10% chance it's one of these other two. That would still be better. You could check all three with a classical computer.
Yeah. And then also what we have kind of focused on until now is the problem of a single solution for the search problem, right? Meaning that only one of the items in your bag is red. But what's also beautiful about these classes of algorithms is that they can be applied to problems with multiple solutions. Continuing with our analogy is you have more than one item that is that has a color of red in your bag.
This is sounding more and more like quantum annealing and finding local minimums.
Well, it resembles, and it kind of actually quantum annealing uses some of the learnings and some of the ideas from this one. And they're really, really kind of close in many ways. Now, because I know you are your field of expertise and hence also means that you are a big fan is security and cryptography, right? Yeah. Again, without getting into the nitty-gritty details of the math, but essentially what this algorithm does, it solves the task of what is usually known as the function inversion, right? So think a bit like the very simplistic definition of a function is y equals f of x, right? This is the universal definition. And the way this typically happens is given x, you need to calculate y, right? Now, what Grover's algorithms gives you is given y, you can find x. So this basically is the reason why Grover's algorithm is very, very interesting when applied to brute force attacks on symmetric keys cryptography. And this is why I mentioned in the beginning, right, that there's already talk about, oh, we really need to at least double the sizes of the standard symmetric keys, because there's already like a proven threat to, to that.
Yeah, Shor's algorithm is a threat to asymmetric keys, public-private keys. Grover's algorithm is a threat, though a lesser threat, to symmetric keys.
Yep. And then the other thing we must now, getting to the other side of the coin, right? We must say that whenever we say the word search, Patrick, a lot of folks are kind of unavoidably going to searching in a database, right?
Right.
And while Grover's original paper refers to this as a database search algorithm, right? We should not confuse this with our regular classical computing databases, where think of like having a table with 5 billion rows, and then, oh, so it means that we can use Grover or amplitude amplification to very quickly find rows in that table, because this is not that.
Right.
Right. In fact, reading a database item by item, right, and transforming it into a representation that the algorithm can work with can easily take much, much more time than actually running the algorithm.
So right? my impression is that you just pointed out something very interesting. Grover is not about searching a database.
Exactly.
And it's also not about searching for whether beads are white or red, but it's I foresee that it's going to be used in finding polymer combinations that are stable at room temperature, or finding, you know, processes that produce a stable element with the minimum number of carbon particles, or so it's really about searching among states in physical sciences is where I see it being applied.
Yeah. I think this is one of the potential applications in there, because at the end of the day, the database in quotes that Grover referred in the original paper is actually a table of the outputs of the function that you are working with, right? And the Oracle basically allows you to take every entry in this list and gives you a true or false, meaning, yes, this entry is a solution of the problem. No, this entry is not a solution of the problem. So, and this is one of the limitations of the Grover algorithm, which is you need to have the correct representation of your problem, and you need to have the oracle in order to apply amplitude amplification or Grover's algorithm. And this is basically what is the cornerstone limitation of all this, because unless you have these, right, it is very, very difficult for you to do that. Now, there are some modifications of these algorithms, which I really, really like, and they are commonly referred as partial search, right? So, so far, what we have discussed is simply searching, like in a given space, for a solution that we can identify, right? Now, think about partial search, and let me try to provide an analogy here, right? Let's think about numbers represented in binary, right? And you have a list of numbers with their binary representations, and you are looking for one of these numbers, which your Oracle can identify, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. With partial search, you're not really interested in finding the whole binary representation of the number that is the solution, only the first few digits. And that's where it plays into what you have mentioned previously, Patrick, where if you can narrow down the problem to a reasonably sized space, you can then move back into classical computing and apply well-known approaches to actually find the solution, which to me is, let's say, a much more realistic short-term usage of this, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So basically, what's really important here to remember, and I know we probably went a little bit on the technical side of things, but I would say that the thing to remember from this discussion on amplitude amplification is that this is one of the fundamental approaches that quantum computing provides to us to design algorithms.
Thank you for listening to Entangled Things. This week's episode is sponsored by Pulsar Security. Introducing Sonar, Wi-Fi security as a service. With Wi-Fi being available in most corporate networks, it is imperative companies know what devices are broadcasting within range or authenticating to the corporate network. With Sonar, you'll receive alerts, monthly reports, and access to our team to uncover and help fix your Wi-Fi security weaknesses. Sonar, protect your data. Visit sonar.pulsarsecurity.com/entangled to learn more.
And let's just quickly recap the process, because I think it's important, right?
Agreed.
So step number one, you take your system of qubits and you set it to an initial state. It's a well-known state. You fully control it. So that is a fairly easy task to have, right? Next, you apply a number of changes on these states. And again, the math is pretty complex, but suffice to say that after a number of such iterations, which are called Grover iterations, we can mathematically prove that if you read the state of your system, there is a very high probability that you actually have found the solution to your search problem. And again, the big advantage here is that instead of being a complexity of n being the size of your space, it's actually a complexity of the square of n. And if we move back to the classical database, again, it's not an analogy that is entirely accurate, but I think it will help our audience. It's like instead of searching in a space, let's say, of a trillion records in a table, it's like searching in a space of a million records in a table, which is the square root of a trillion, right? So this is a good kind of image on understanding how powerful is a complexity of the square root of n compared to a complexity of n, even in classical systems, right? Yeah. So if we were able to do that, basically no data structure in the world today would be unsearchable with classical computing. So this is one of the very, very powerful promises that that this algorithm is providing. And I think the key takeaway from this episode is not necessarily understanding how the algorithm works, but remembering the fact that despite this amazing limitation that we have with quantum computing, that we cannot actually read into the states because they always collapse and we get an either a zero or a one for each qubit. Despite this limitation, we already have ways to solve various types of problems like the search, like the factorization and things like that, which for me is very, very promising. So I'm curious here, Patrick, what is your take on how the process of designing algorithms is evolving with quantum computing? How do you see it? Is it where you think it should be? Do you see major hurdles in it? What's your take on this one? Because I'd be really curious to pick your brain on this.
I think that's an interesting question. I'd say that for me, digging into Grover's algorithm and trusting that the Oracle formula was something that could be attained allowed me to get past a major obstacle and get into understanding interference. That's really where I understood interference best. There's a couple of other algorithms where, like the Deutsch-Jose algorithm is another one where quantum interference is probably the easier one to approach. You got to get past the Oracle in order to understand interference, in my opinion. Once you understand that, then the Oracle becomes the issue. And I want to diverge a little bit for you and talk about genetic algorithms. Are you familiar with, in the past, and this is probably 15, 20 years old, when I considered going back to school and getting a master's and PhD in computer science, I was very interested in genetic algorithms. And for those who've never heard of them, genetic algorithms is the idea that I can take a program that I'm trying to design. And the typical one that I've used as an example is, let's say I'm trying to develop a chip or a process that can identify the pitch of a sound perfectly. And I don't know how to write that off the top of my head, but I know how to evaluate it. In other words, I know how to write the Oracle to test whether a sound has perfect pitch. To test whether my program can detect the perfect pitch. It's a little bit of a subtle difference. And what I do is I use that to test genetically developed algorithms that I breed over the course of generations to come up with an algorithm that in the end can do the task perfectly, but I don't understand how it was written because it evolved instead of being written. And so that always fascinated me. I never went in and took the courses necessary or really even found out where genetic algorithms have ended up. But it seemed like it was a different way of thinking. It seemed like it would require a very different mindset. And I think the Oracle is in that same category. It requires a very different mindset to know how to write the Oracle. But you have to understand quantum interference first.
Yeah. Totally agree. And it's not only the Oracle part, but also the so-called Grover iteration, right? Because at first sight, it seems to be like a little bit of magic. It's like, how come you can take a system in a known initial state, iterate on it, and then do it in a way that it basically kind of moves its state closer and closer and closer to the solution state, right? This is at first sight is kind of like a little bit of magic that you have in there, but this magic is fully mathematically provable. So actually, it's not magic at all, right?
I think by comparison, the Harry Potter movies have a little bit of magic. This is a lot of magic. there's a lot going on here. It's a leap of faith. You have to understand that it does work, and getting to a point, it's cumulative. It's a lot of different steps along the way, and a lot of examples. And we're still in the infancy. I know I keep saying that, but this is very early days for quantum computing. There's a lot that we're going to take for granted in 20 years that is still yet undisclosed, undiscovered.
Yep. That's true. And for those who want to kind of get into the more details, right, getting into a deeper level of understanding, there is, I think, one book that stands out of all the others. It's written by Michael Nielsen and Isaac Chung, which is Quantum Computation and Quantum Information. It's already, I think, more than 10 years old with a number of updates, but I still find that, especially when it comes to learning or starting to understand more about quantum algorithms, especially the ones that we have mentioned multiple times, the Deutsch-Jozsa, the Grover algorithm, the Shor algorithm. This is the book, so to speak, right, where which provides the foundations to dive into this amazing world. And also what I would like to add, because we are close to the end of this episode, is I hope that we will get one day to a point where all of this will be abstracted inside some higher level quantum libraries that will just allow us to say, oh, we have this problem. Here's the Grover library that we can use, and we will not really need to understand the nitty-gritty details of that. And that's something we've covered in the past, Patrick, as well, right?
Yeah, I'm still reticent to believe that's the case. I think it's still going to be a higher bar to get into this computing than it is in classical computing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So keep studying.
Yep. And I think we're at time for this episode. This has certainly been a very, very interesting discussion. Our deep dive into the next big quantum algorithm, which is Grover's algorithm. Remember, we covered in past episodes the Shor algorithm, the factorization one, and Just keep on listening, because certainly we will dive into some other classes of algorithms in the future as well.
Fascinating stuff. Thanks a lot, Cyprian, and never disappoints. I'll be talking to you soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Patrick.
Bye.
Bye.